David swipes an ID card through a discreetly placed and nearly unnoticeable reader. The door lock clicks and a soft bell chimes. David opens the door and walks in. "Whoa, what's all this?" says Mike in amazement at what he sees. "This is part of my computer operation. This is where I was watching you from last night," replies David. Mike sees that the room runs the length of the south side of the building, then appears to turn at the far east end. Mike asks, "How far does this go on for?" "Runs all around the building, all the way back to the other side of the freight elevator. It's one continuous operation center. The room, if it can be called a room, is about 30 feet wide and runs the circumference of the building. All along the inner wall, that dividing it from the balcony outside, are racks of servers. Each server rack is a black steel frame about 2 feet wide, 6 feet high, and about 3 feet deep. Each server rack is packed from top to bottom with computers, each with its own set of blinking lights and switches. Behind each server rack are hundreds of cables, power conductors, Ethernet and fiber optic lines. Large, yellow, corrugated round air ducts suspended from the ceiling run the length of the wall. The fans on the servers give off loud, high-pitched whines as they suck air from the room through the machines and exhaust it to the ducts above. From each server rack rises a web of cables to massive steel cable trays near the ceiling and running the length of the wall. The finish on all the equipment is buff black, with switches and multicolored LED lights that twinkle ceaselessly. The effect is that of a wall of blinking lights. "What's all the noise?" shouts Mike. "It's the cooling fans. They tend to be a bit annoying at times," replies Mike. "Yeah, try threshold of pain. It's not that bad. You'll get used to it. A lot of white noise helps you concentrate anyway. Come on, for now, I'll show you the rest of the place." And David guides Mike past more banks of servers, processors, disk drives, fiber optic network connections, workstations, and displays. After looping the building, they exit from a door only a few feet from where they entered. David opens the elevator gate and they walk in. When they reach the main floor, he leads Mike over to the bar. As Mike sits on a stool, David goes around and grabs some glasses. He scoops up some ice, then pulls out a mixer dispensing hose and fills each with some cola. They gossip about people they knew from school while shelling peanuts and drinking the pop. Further down the bar, Todd is talking on the phone. Mike watches and sees Todd's expression is grim. Todd hangs up the phone and quickly walks over behind the bar to David. Leaning over the bar, covering his mouth, he whispers something in David's ear. David mumbles something back. Now they both look concerned. There are a few more exchanges, then Todd nods and steps back and leans on the bar with his right arm, facing Mike. "You remember Todd," says David. Mike says, "Yeah, sure." Todd says, "Nice to see you again. Right now we got a little problem." Mike says to Todd, "How little?" "Big little. First, I was able to track one of the numbers on your phone list. It called a cell phone here in Omaha last night. Still working on the name of the party called." "How'd you know that?" "I cracked the cell tower encryption codes and set some computers to scan all incoming traffic looking for caller IDs with numbers on your list. One of them called here. Some guy from your cell phone book listed as Pete." "Oh, crap. That doesn't sound good," says Mike with a note of panic in his voice. "Any reason he might call someone in Omaha?" asks David. "Yeah, I'm probably overreacting. Sure, may have had nothing to do with me. He does business here all the time. Just might be a normal call." "Okay, but that's not all," David adds. "The guys we sent over this morning to your motel, Jim and Sean, say when they got there, they found some guys there looking over your car. Seems they've discovered that your car had some bullet damage." That would be correct. Hardly noticeable, actually, from the front. Shouldn't reduce the trade-in value very much, unless you're picky about that sort of thing." "Well, at least it didn't have a steel wheel from a freight train mounted on the hood," said David. "So you think this means something?" "But I mean, a car with bullet holes probably attracts a lot of attention," says Mike. Todd continues, "There's more. Jim and Sean waited when Jim followed those guys into the lobby. They were asking the desk clerk about you. Jim overheard what they said. Whoever's looking for you, they have a positive ID on you, and they've got a strong link to the club. We got some digital telephoto shots of them, the license plate number of their car, and a couple of MPEG videos. After the guy from the lobby and his friend left, they walked up here and looked around." "Here? Uh-oh. They know I'm here?" "Probably. Come over here and see if you recognize these guys." Mike gets up, walks around the back of the bar to the computer podium and looks at the photos. "Yep, I know them. They work odd jobs for the organization." "How the freaking hell do they find my motel?" asks Mike with a rising voice of concern. "Probably from the credit card you used, same as I did, but we have managed to ID both of them. One is named Tom Schaefer, 5'10", blonde hair, blue eyes, age 22, and the other is named Bob McCarthy, 6'3", dark brown hair, green eyes, also age 22. Lance's guess is that they were probably sent to follow up on the credit card record you left at the motel. That might explain the cell phone call last night. So you know these guys?" "Yeah, like I say, they do odd jobs. They mainly worked out of eastern Iowa, which, as you say, is where they're from. I guess they must be working over here now." "Okay, so I'm assuming last night's cell phone call was to one of these guys, since, right after they got to your motel, the same cell phone that received the call last night called this guy Pete in Des Moines. So I'm guessing it must be theirs." "Sounds like a match," says David. "Is there anything else we should know?" says Todd. Mike chokes a bit. Todd reaches behind the bar for a glass and a bottle and pours Mike a glass of scotch and, smiling somewhat insincerely, pushes it across the bar. Mike takes a gulp and lights a cigarette. His hand shakes a bit as he begins. "Well, if you put it that way, I guess you should know who I work for in the mob. I work for Jack Myers of St. Louis. The Jack Myers." David looks wryly at Todd, eyebrows slightly raised, then back at Mike. Todd pours two more drinks. "I met Jack soon after I began the investigation. You gotta understand, Jack's been running the show in St. Louis for the past 8 years. Jack controls just about every dealer, cooker, maker, pusher, and trucker in the trade from Minneapolis to New Orleans. Suffice it to say, he's not an easy guy to deal with, and I had access to everything, and he knows that. He's not going to take what happened yesterday with the train very well." Probably not. "Train wrecks piss people off, I hear," says David. "Also, your friend Stan's murder could not have happened without Jack knowing and approving. For all I know, I might even have a record of what he paid to have the job done on my computer. Like I said, I copied everything, and they kept surprisingly detailed records. In code, of course." David looks at Todd, Todd at David, both back at Mike. Then David says, "Well then, I guess we can assume that they probably won't give up without a nasty fight. It would appear that Jack has a vested interest in seeing you become seriously dead. You're right about that. I'm not going to be safe until I get my story written. But once I publish it and dump all the data on the public record, Jack will have other problems. Lots of other problems besides me. In the meantime, if Jack knows I'm here, he won't be fooling around. He'll send people to get me. A lot of people. And quick. Very quick. You won't want someone with what I know loose on the streets. Full-scale attack? Yep, the works. You can assume Tom and Bob are small fish. They're just the scouts. The big problems will begin when the real troops get here." "So you don't think our friends from the motel are the main event?" asks Todd. "Hell no, they're just guys that do errands. They just pick up and deliver the gack, maybe a little ganja peddling. I don't think they're the hitmen. The real professionals are yet to come." "Okay, what's a gack?" "It's methamphetamine. Speed. Crank. Gack. There's a lot of names. And ganja? Actually, it's a Sanskrit word. Most people think it's Jamaican slang." "And what does it mean?" "Hemp, man. Marijuana. Pot. Cannabis. Weed. I live and learn." "Okay, vocabulary lesson over. You do understand what I just told you? There's big trouble headed this way?" says Mike. "I do indeed. For now, we lie low and watch and see what develops. For starters, a lot of extra security. And you, stay upstairs when the club is open. There's no way they can get up there," says David. "And I'll crack their phone network. I've got your list of numbers. My computers will scan for any activity in Omaha on any of those caller IDs." Mike says, "No, man, I can't drag you into this. You know, maybe when Jay gets here, we should really leave and head west. I didn't want to cause all this trouble here. Don't worry. After what happened in St. Louis, I'm ready for a chance to take that bastard on." David sees Lance walk by on the other side of the bar and calls out for him to come over. He walks over and says to Mike, "Hey, man, I guess some people are looking for you." "Yeah, it kind of looks that way." "Don't worry. They won't get you. I guarantee it. More or less. Thanks, I think. More or less. Anyway, I appreciate the help." "No problem." David gets a text message on his phone. He quickly sends it acknowledgement, flips the phone shut, and says, "I'm going to have a talk with Lance about where things stand. But in the meantime, you are to go see the nice ladies up in your apartment." "Huh?" "Okay, they're not nice ladies. They're more like a brood of angry badgers. But they won't bite. Well, most of them won't. Anyway, they've had their shots, I think," says David. "What do you mean?" "Oh, you'll see. It's a surprise. It was Mary's idea. She just texted me that she's ready, and I didn't have any choice in the matter." "Exactly what do you mean by surprise, and explain what Mary's up to?" "Mary's in one of her deranged leprechaun moods. As I said, she occasionally lets me delude myself into thinking that I run this place, but only while she shops online. As to the surprise, you don't think she tells me anything, do you? You go find out. I'm only taking orders here." "Shouldn't she know about this? Don't you want to tell her what's happened?" "What makes you think she hasn't been listening?" says Todd, as he points to the webcam over the bar with its light glowing green. "I should have known." Just then a page cackles from the speaker system. "Quit yapping and send him up here." "She's not patient," says David. "Jeez, is she dangerous?" "Yes. Now go. She doesn't like to be kept waiting." Mike walks off and enters the elevator room. Lance asks, "What's Mary up to?" "Duh. Shopping? What else? She and the other weird sisters are going to do a makeover on Mike. And you didn't warn him? Would you?" "Ha, no. I think I'd be too chicken." "Well, this better be good. She's got one of my gold cards. No telling what he'll be dressed like the next time we see him." Time, 6 p.m. It's a little after 6 p.m. as he knocks on David's door. "It's open," David hollers. David, Todd, Lois, and Jane are in the living room. Mary comes in from the kitchen and hands Mike a scotch and soda, then reaches behind her back for a bladder of cheese, crackers, and nuts, which he puts on the table. Mike sits down on one of the couches. "By the way, I hope you weren't too traumatized by us girls this afternoon." "Traumatized? I was terrorized." She laughs and says, "Honey, we were gentle on you. You got off easy. And those new clothes look nice." She goes back to getting things ready for supper. As they talk, in the wide south-facing window, stars rise as the frigid night descends. Mary rejoins them, sits on the couch next to David, swings her arm around him, lights a cigarette, and puffs a large smoke ring towards the beams above. "So, Mary," Mike begins, "how did you meet David?" "Oh, I was a nurse at Vermin Death Lodge in St. Louis when he had visions of curing the world. world. He was a med student, and my job was to follow med students around and undo the damage they did. He was a full-time project. Vermin Death Lodge? Huh? The nickname of the hospital, answers David. And I never actually lost a patient. Misplaced a few, maybe, but never actually lost one. No, after we figured out I'd trap you and your kind in the employee elevator, dearie, you fell for that every time. What? We nurses used to page you students to the 9th floor, then have maintenance stop the elevator between floors. You what? What, you didn't know? Didn't you think it was tiny bit suspicious that every time you got paged to 9 West, you got trapped in the elevator? 9 West in the page was the code we used to tell maintenance to stop the elevator. What? I thought it was just an old elevator. Why 9 West? Davy, honey, there was no 9 West. Jeez, it must have been a wonderful place to get sick, says Mike, rolling his eyes. It was when he was on his way to 9 West. You don't pull any stunts like that here, do you? Asks David. Honey, would I do a thing like that? Yeah, I guess that would sort of cut into your home shopping channel time.